Warfish is a short story written by Terry Mixon and recorded by the author. It was inspired by the book of the same name written by Captain George Gritter, U.S. Navy retired, and Lydell Sims in 1958 and honors the men of the U.S. Navy submarine service. Their bravery and sacrifice during World War II stands as a monument to what it means to be heroes. 52 submarines were lost during the war, and all too many of those brave souls lie in unmarked watery graves because of their valor. They were giants. Lieutenant Commander Ray Hennicutt put his shoulder to the subspace torpedo and heaved. Sweat beaded on his forehead and his uniform sleeve tore under the strain, but the torpedo refused to budge. It was jammed partway into tube number 5, one of the two stern torpedo tubes. He wiped his forehead with his torn sleeve. Damn it! That was my second best uniform, too. Maybe we can get it loose if we all get in here. Be careful it doesn't pop out and crush you. The three other men in the aft torpedo room squeezed in and grunted in unison as they all pulled together. Twice as many men would have been better, but there just wasn't space in the teeny room for anyone else. The walls were jam-packed with heavy metal racks holding torpedoes, and there was barely enough room to load one into a sling and force it over to one of the tubes. A submarine's notorious cramped nature was even worse in the aft torpedo room because it had to steal space from engineering. With the supralight drive, the normal space drive, the subspace drive, and the massive nuclear pile that allowed them to slip into subspace in the first place, there was very little room to spare. Space limitations were made worse when subspace physics were taken into account. The power requirements to enter subspace went up sharply with the size of the ship. The only thing that made torpedoes even possible was the fact that the sub was already in subspace when they were fired. The torpedo, or fish as it was unofficially called, finally popped loose with the sound of scraping metal like talons on a chalkboard. Hennicutt staggered back, careful of the massive warhead and drive combo as it swung on its sling. Two of the men started manhandling the torpedo back to its rack, and Master Chief Tony Bosworth stood there shaking his head.
The tube must have deformed on that last shot at the convoy, Skipper. Those things don't have much clearance to begin with, and if the subspace drive kicks off too hot, it can warp the tube.
I want the other tubes checked ASAP. If this happens to us when the heat is on, we're in deep kimchi. Bosworth gave a sharp nod of his head.
Aye, aye, sir. You'll have a report on their condition before the end of the shift.
Good enough, Master Chief. Carry on. Hennicutt slid through the airlock and into the central corridor of the USS Flasher, the current leader in kills for the Southern Subspace Fleet. A proud record, and one he had every intention of keeping. The two freighters that they had picked off over the last month would certainly help in that tally, but he didn't want to miss an opportunity because he only had one stern tube. Admittedly, the four bow tubes were the primary weapons on a submarine, but the stern tubes deterred destroyers from chasing too closely. The pipes running along the walls gurgled as he pressed against them to let two men pass with what looked like a load of beans for the galley. Wonderful. Time to shift Lieutenant Gorman, the executive officer, to the engine room. At least they were used to deadly fumes down there. He followed the men into the galley and shamelessly eavesdropped on the XO as he argued about the menu for tomorrow's dinner with the cook. It was one of Gorman's duties, and he really should stay above the fray, but Hennicutt was getting tired of the bland diet. And of the chocolate ice cream. The cook seemed to have a fetish for the stuff, and as much as Hennicutt liked it, it was getting old.
I've got tomorrow all lined up, Lieutenant. Believe me, the crew loves my vegetable stew.
Gorman shook his head.
We've had it 5 times in 2 weeks, Beck. I'd rather see something like steak. You remember what that is, right? I hope so, because I've almost forgotten. It feels like we're on survival rations.
Beck puffed up.
What's wrong with my stew?
Hennicutt smiled. Beck might not be a chef in the literal sense, but he had the ego of one. Time to intervene.
There's nothing wrong with the stew. However, in this case I agree with the XO. Oh, and I'd take it as a personal favor if you could serve some vanilla ice cream to go along with it. Beck scowled, but nodded slowly.
I didn't see you there, Skipper. I don't think the crew will be happy with the change, but you're the boss. Steak and potatoes it is. If you'll excuse me...
Honeycutt watched the little man huff off into the bowels of the galley with subdued amusement.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Gorman snorted.
What's amazing is how he can read a crowd so wrong. The crew is ready to space him, and I'm considering helping. I've lost 10 pounds since we started this patrol, and if I have more vegetable stew, I might just lose my mind.
Honeycutt laughed. That was one of the problems of a long patrol. Not only were they out of contact with everyone else, they had to live with what they carried with them for months on end.
You've obviously been on patrol too long, Todd. One more month, and we'll be heading back to base, and you can stuff your face with whatever you like. If, of course, you can tear yourself away from the ladies.
Gorman's face lit up.
Man, you sure know how to put things in perspective, Ray. There's nothing like a month-long layover in New Perth to boost my morale. Those Aussie women, they sure know how to show a bachelor a good time, and with all their men off to war...
He let the sentence trail off to leave the obvious unstated and nodded at Honeycutt.
Not to take anything away from the new Wellington ladies. Anne would shoot me if I tried that. Having both planets in one system, though, is like a cosmic twofer.
The thought of completing their patrol brought a smile to Honeycutt's face. He couldn't wait to see his wife again, to hear that sexy accent of hers. New Perth, where all the submarines in this sector were housed for refit, might be the focus of most of his crew's fantasies, but his heart longed to return to New Wellington. Anne had inspelled him on that first sightseeing trip to New Wellington after the war had started, when he'd first been assigned to Flasher and was waiting for her readiness trials to be completed. He'd courted her on his second layover, and she'd agreed to marry him on the third. Their honeymoon had been magical, and he'd hated leaving her to return to duty. This patrol had only been 2 months long, but it felt like a year. He missed her so badly. He shook his head and dragged his mind back to the present.
Yeah, pal, don't try to compare the two sets of ladies. Aussies are nice, but the new Wellington girls leave them in the dust. Now for some bad news. Looks like we're down to one stern tube.
Gorman grimaced.
I was afraid of that. That'll make us more reliant on the forward tubes than I like. If push comes to shove, we might not be able to service all of our customers.
Honeycutt clapped his hawk-nosed fellow officer on the shoulder.
We still have the 4 bow tubes. That should be enough. If we need all the tubes at one time, we're already in hot water.
What if we hit it lucky and we catch a heavy cruiser and its escorts? You bet your ass we'll need all our tubes then.
He grinned.
We can dream.
The XO snorted.
More like a nightmare. They'd depth charge us into the next dimension.
The intercom crackled to life, and the voice of his sensor officer, Lieutenant Zucker, rang out.
Captain to the control room. XO to the control room.
The two men glanced at one another, their good humor evaporating. Honeycutt took the lead back to the control room. Zucker was huddled over his console when they stepped through the hatch.
What have you got, Sound?
The name was traditional, much like calling a tactical officer on a larger ship guns. This wasn't a deep-sea vessel, and they didn't use sonar. Nonetheless, Sound was what he was called.
I'm picking up ships in superlight at extreme range.
How many, and on what heading?
Zucker focused on his screen. It's a tight wave, Skipper. Could be as many as 24 ships. Might be as few as 10. I'll know more when they drop into normal space. They're coming in above the plane of the ecliptic, just like you guessed they would. I make their emergence point to be about 050035 at 10 million kilometers. Almost in our laps. Call it 5 minutes until emergence.
Good work. Helm, flank speed on that heading.
Aye, sir. Flank speed on 050035.
Their center of gravity briefly shifted as the ship changed heading and jumped to maximum acceleration. XO, Sound General Quarters. Honeycutt grabbed the mic beside the periscope and switched to the all-ship channel.
All hands to battle stations. This is not a drill. I repeat, this is not a drill. Load all tubes and stand by to dive.
He hung the mic back up and returned to the plot beside the sensor console. It showed a small graphical representation of the morass system and marked their location with a small blue dot. The unknown convoy was marked with a dotted red line terminating almost at solar north, out near the Lowell limit, the closest a ship could exit superlight near a star. The Flash's plotted course was marked with a dotted green line that terminated close to the most likely path the convoy would take. Maneuverability once the sub dove into subspace was strictly limited, so they needed to be in a spot where the enemy would bring themselves into range. If they guessed wrong, they'd have to wait for them to pass and circle around outside sensor range to get back in front of them and drop back into hiding. Good thing freighters were slow.
Status change. Looks like there's a single ship running in advance of the convoy. That contact has been designated Bogey 1.
Gorman peered at the plot.
Probably a tin can running out front to make sure the outer system is clear. Since they're coming to Ottoman base, that's probably a bunch of Shogunate freighters filled with critical military supplies. They'd like to avoid running into a commerce raider squadron picketing the fringes of a major base like this one, so they're coming out of superlight well off the beaten path.
Ottoman base was a major Shogunate naval facility located in the system that acted as a launching point for strikes into Union space. That was why they were coasting along in the outer system, way out beyond sensor range, both to keep watch for an attack force and to deter enemy resupply efforts.
I like the way you think, XO. Let's hope for some juicy targets. A few freighters would sit nice on the balance sheet. How long until Bogey 1 exits superlight sound? 3 minutes if he pops out where I expect. Minimum of 2.5.
Honeycutt walked back to the periscope housing and grabbed the mic again. He switched to a dedicated line to the engine room.
Engine room, con. We dive in 90 seconds. Prepare to switch over to batteries.
It was too damn bad. All major power generating schemes wouldn't work once they were in subspace. All the extra power that they had in normal space was gone once they dove. The quantum field there dampened all nuclear reaction, and that really put a crimp on operations. Almost anything that could have been done with automation had to be done by hand when crunch time came, because they couldn't spare the power. He watched the clock count down. At the 90-second mark, he nodded to Gorman.
Dive the boat, XO.
He keyed the all-ship channel as the dive klaxon started to sound.
All hands, dive, dive, dive.
There was an abrupt lurch as the main drive cut off. On the helmsman's plot, the stars slowly faded into the swirling gray of subspace, that layer of reality just below the normal universe. From the outside, the ship would seem to have become momentarily translucent and then faded from sight. The internal lighting dimmed as they switched to battery power, leaving the corners of the room lost in the gloom.
Helm, take us to periscope depth.
He waited for the ship to stabilize before raising the periscope. It was too far away for the naked eye to get a good look at the emerging ship, but the passive sensors on the scope could pick out a surprising amount of information, including enhanced visuals. There was a good reason the periscope was the most expensive piece of equipment on the sub, not even counting the exotic materials required to bridge a vessel in subspace with the normal universe. Zucker would keep a passive track on the convoy while he used the periscope for precise targeting tracks and confirmed identifications. The sensor officer would also be crunching the data from the periscope. If Honeycutt made a bad ID, Zucker would straighten him out before he did anything permanent.
Bogey 1 has dropped out of superlight right on the money. He's pinging subspace, but he's way out of detection range. He's probably also scanning hard in normal space. We just can't detect it.
Honeycutt trained the periscope on the lead ship and waited for the data to reach the scope. Unlike subspace waves, normal space data was limited to the speed of light, so it took 33 seconds to reach him. That was also why they dove at least 60 seconds before the enemy could have emerged. He could look all he liked, but there were no visuals of the sub for him to catch. When the ship appeared in his scope, he centered it and increased the magnification. The image of the ship snapped into sharp focus and confirmed the XO's guess. It was definitely a Shogunate destroyer.
The XO wins a prize. One tin can sniffing around before the convoy drops out of superlight. ETA on the convoy?
2 minutes. Helm, assume that they'll be following in Bogey One's tracks and see if you can nudge us into a more favorable setup that leaves us some evasion options. You bet your ass there'll be more than one tin can riding herd on a convoy that size. On it, Skipper. The seconds seemed to flow by like cold molasses while he waited for the convoy to drop out of superlight. He chided himself for his impatience, but it didn't help. Hell, in a less optimal situation, they might have to stalk a convoy for days to get a shot, if they even managed to get one. He'd watched some juicy targets slip by because they were in the wrong place, and that always sucked. The convoy has dropped into normal space. We have 16 additional targets, designated bogeys 2 through 17. They emerged at the same spot as Bogey 1 and seemed to be following his trajectory. Honeycutt tapped his foot and waited for the speed of light data to come in so that he could see exactly what they'd be dealing with. As the ship started popping up, he zeroed in on each one to make an ID. A cold knife seemed to dig into his guts. This was not the convoy that he'd been expecting. Identifications are coming in. I count 6 destroyers, 4 light cruisers, 4 heavy cruisers, 2 battle cruisers, and 1 carrier.
Holy crap! It's not a convoy. It's a carrier task force.
It sure is, and it gives us a chance to take out an enemy carrier. That doesn't happen every day. They only have a few of the damn things, so if we can damage it, that would be huge. Helm, plot a course to bring us closer. I want a least time solution for torpedoes with minimum risk to us. Honeycutt brought the periscope back down. He wouldn't raise it again until it was almost time to fire the torpedoes. Gorman's eyes widened.
We can't get that close to heavy metal. 1 destroyer is a risk, 2 a real danger, but this is suicide. They'll be on us like white on rice the moment we launch the first torpedo.
Honeycutt eyed the XO coolly. That's why they pay us the big bucks, Todd. We'll do our best to get clear before they zero in on us, but we can't pass up that carrier.
You have an obligation to bring this crew home again.
We have an obligation to hurt the enemy, too. We will do our duty, XO. That carrier's worth dozens of subs, and we will take it out if we can. Are you reading me?
But
that's enough, Lieutenant. My orders are not open to debate.
Gorman looked like he wanted to argue further, but he only clenched his teeth and took a deep breath through his nose.
Aye, aye, sir.
Honeycutt watched him walk stiffly back to stand behind the helm officer. He sympathized. He really did. He had no more desire to die than the next man. He had a beautiful wife waiting for him to come home, but their duty was crystal clear, and the executive officer of an attack sub should know that. Under normal circumstances, a sub would pass by a target that was too heavily protected. Sub warfare was like a sucker punch more than a stand-up fight. Hit a ship, dodge the reaction, and maybe take another shot later on if you could safely do so from the depths. Gorman was right in saying that this had an element of suicide about it. Their odds of even getting into range to take the shot were slim. Their odds of dodging the retribution were slimmer still. If there wasn't a carrier in there, he wouldn't risk it at all. He shook his head sharply. He didn't have time to worry about Gorman's cold feet or about widowing his wife. He had a ship to sink, and he needed to keep his wits about him if he wanted to bring his people home again.
Captain, I think there's enough of a gap in the screening elements to get through without tripping any alarms, but we'll need to set speed to slow and move closer.
Honeycutt considered the risks versus the rewards. Getting past the screening destroyers would allow them a much better chance of hitting the carrier. On the flip side, movement would raise the odds that one of the escorts would spot them before they could take a shot. He took a deep breath.
Helm, lay in the course. All ahead, 1/3.
The XO jerked a little, but he said nothing. He gave Gorman's back a considering stare. Maybe he could do something to help take his friend's mind off the impending ass-whooping they were about to earn.
XO, with the stakes going up like this, we'll need to have the aft torpedo room at peak efficiency. You served on the Hawkbill as a torpedo officer. I want you back there so I can leave Lieutenant Becker in the forward torpedo room.
Gorman whipped around. His eyes narrowed.
Sir, if something happens to you, I need to be in the control room.
I appreciate your dedication, Mr. Gorman, but the aft torpedo room is probably going to be critical to our survival. With only 1 tube back there, I want max speed in reloading when we have to run for it.
The average is 30 seconds to reload. I expect you and Master Chief Bosworth can beat that. You don't have much time, so you'd best be going." He didn't look at all pleased, but he left at a run. The next few minutes were nerve-wracking. If the destroyers closed the gap the Flasher was heading for, they would almost certainly spot them. It felt like the temperature had risen to over 100 degrees. With main power offline, it probably had. They were all soaked with sweat by the time they were edging through the screening elements.
"Captain, one of the light cruisers has changed course and increased speed. He's heading right toward us."
"All stop." He watched the plot with the cold certainty that they'd been spotted. At the very least, someone had seen something that worried them, and they wanted a closer look. He waited with dread for the cruiser to go to active subspace pinging. He waited, and it never came. The light cruiser passed almost directly over the Flasher and moved out into the gap that they had already slipped through, taking up station. Then they went active. Flasher was inside the outer perimeter. The inner perimeter was made up of heavy cruisers and battle cruisers. The remaining light cruisers were moving to strengthen the outer perimeter. It was a smart move that would have effectively kept them at bay if the Flasher hadn't been almost under them when they came out of superlight. That was good news, but he knew that while the lighter ships were the primary anti-sub forces, the big ships in front of him were more than capable of taking his ship out all by themselves.
"Designate the carrier, Target 1. Time to firing range?"
"We're at extreme range now, Captain. Bogey 15, one of the battlecruisers, is partly between us, though. We'll be in standard firing range in 2 minutes if they maintain course and speed. This data won't be completely verified until we take a snapshot through the periscope."
Honeycutt flipped the mic selector.
"Forward torpedo room, Con. We'll be in range in a few minutes. I'll want as fast a reload time as you can once we start firing."
He was going to have to risk a peek through the periscope before much longer. Without the precise range and targeting information, the torpedoes might pick the wrong target or be too deep in subspace to effectively damage the target when they went off. Or, God forbid, they might miss entirely. The periscope was well shielded, but you never knew when someone would get lucky and spot it. He said a quick prayer that they would remain undetected and raise the periscope. The battlecruiser was still partly between him and the carrier, but he could get a decent reading. The carrier looked like one of their newer Hansho class, making it one of the most powerful in space. It could put out 8 squadrons of fighters and swamp all but the stoutest of defenses. He made careful note of the range to both it and the battlecruiser.
"Captain, that carrier's electronic signature is in the database. It's the Hirohito."
Holy cow. That was their freaking flagship, and that meant that their fleet admiral was sitting on its flag bridge. He wouldn't be here if there wasn't a major offensive in the works. Honeycutt hoped they would survive the retaliatory strike so that they could get word home before the offensive began.
"The battlecruiser isn't in my database, but it's one of the Togo class."
It didn't matter at this point, but he'd already recognized that. All battlecruisers were arrogant and sleek with power, but the Togo class was even more so. Not a match on a tonnage-for-tonnage basis with their own Raven-class ships, but nothing to sneer at. It could run down anything smaller than itself and stand up to anything short of a system's fixed defenses. It outmassed the largest military ship the Flasher had taken out by a factor of 6 and was dwarfed by the carrier powering along under its protection. He made some sightings and assigned targeting information to the 4 torpedoes in the bow tubes. Then he watched the ships grow huge on his viewfinder, reducing the magnification in steps as they came close. An itchy feeling grew between his shoulder blades, like someone was aiming a weapon right at him. Soon enough, they would be.
"Closest approach coming up, Captain. Torpedo travel time, 30 seconds.
The battlecruiser had moved a little ahead, and they were going to have an unobstructed shot at the Hirohito. Considering travel time, the range was only going to get worse from here on. Honeycutt made one last update to the target's range and heading.
"Beginning attack run. Helm, stand by for flank speed and evasive maneuvers. Firing 1.
The Flasher jolted as the torpedo was kicked free of the ship by its powerful engine. He waited a beat for it to pull away from the ship. If he didn't give it enough lead time, the next torpedo would be knocked off course in its subspace wake.
Firing 2.
Firing firing three. Firing four.
Torpedoes running clean and normal in subspace. First impact in 20 seconds. Honeycutt watched the readiness lights for the forward tubes, waiting for them to go green so that he could unload more shots at the carrier. Every shot made disabling it more likely. The tension on the bridge ratcheted up as they waited for one of the enemy ships to spot the subspace wakes and for all hell to break loose. 5 more seconds went by in what felt like an hour. 10. Still no reaction. They couldn't have missed seeing the torpedoes, could they? No one but an idiot would rely on the screening ships for protecting themselves. Tube 1 went green. The carrier has increased speed and the battlecruiser is turning toward us. 2 of the destroyers are reversing course. It was way too late for the carrier to dodge the first wave of torpedoes, and with the delay in spotting the first wave, he'd get off at least 2 more shots before they had to dive. Probably not enough to sink the carrier, but it would hurt real bad. He fired Tube 1 and then Tube 2 as soon as it went green.
Active pinging over the detection threshold!
He hardly needed that warning, as the thrum of the subspace sonar rang off the hull in the audible range. He had 1 second for a flash of intense satisfaction as he watched the first torpedo detonate under the carrier, disrupting the boundary between normal space and subspace. It tore a chunk out of the ship in a glittering burst of spilled atmosphere and energy. Then the second fish went off right next to it. He opened his mouth to order the ship to dive right as tubes 3 and 4 went green. He made a snap decision to take the risk and to fire them. Firing 3. Firing 4. Dive the boat. Bring us hard about at max angle of descent. He targeted Tube 5 on where the battlecruiser would be as they passed underneath it. O Lord, for what we are about to receive, let us be truly thankful. The ship groaned as it was propelled deeper into subspace. The increased depth would make it harder for the enemy to pinpoint them, but the increased quantum pressure on the hull would crush them like a toy if they went too deep.
We have active pinging from multiple sources closing in from every direction, Captain, and the battlecruiser is dropping depth charges.
They all waited for the explosions to start. If they guessed the right depth or just got lucky, a charge would rip the flasher wide open. No one knew exactly what happened to someone directly exposed to subspace, since the body always vanished, but it probably wasn't good.
Battlecruiser in firing position for the aft torpedo tube in 3, 2, 1.
The hull rang like a gong, and the sub heeled over as the first depth charge went off, throwing him off of his feet. Everything that wasn't secured, and more than a few things that were, crashed to the deck. Glass covers shattered and metal groaned, but the hull stood up to the abuse. 2 more went off in quick succession, smashing the boat hard to port. Whoever had dropped those charges was damned good. Now it was time for payback. He scrambled to his feet, wiped blood off his face from where he'd cut his forehead on something, and hit the firing switch for tube number 5. Nothing happened. He reset the switch and hit it again. Still nothing. He grabbed the mic. Aft torpedo room, Khan, we have negative control on tube 5. Make a best guess on range and fire manually. The ship shuddered moments later as Gorman fired.
More ships dropping depth charges, but we've got multiple hits on the primary target. Subspace is resonating, so it might have been enough to tear off part of him. It might be enough to take him down. The fish from Tube 5 is running clean and normal.
Fat chance of that, Honeycutt thought. It would take a lot of luck for even 4 torpedo hits to sink a ship that big, unless one of them hit it in the drive room. That would be a shot in a million. The odds of any of the second wave hitting the carrier were poor at best. He could hope, but he'd settle for taking the ship out of service for months.
Contact hit on the battlecruiser!
Holy Mother of God. An actual physical hit on a ship with a subspace torpedo would rip its hull wide open.
The torpedoes almost never timed their rise to the normal space boundary just right to get one, especially in the heat of combat. Gorman had just earned one hell of a shore leave on bragging rights alone, if they survived. Then the other depth charges being dropped on them started going off like a chain of firecrackers. The ship rolled from one side to the other, and then the overhead lights went out and the bow jerked up like a boxer that had just taken the mother of all uppercuts. An alarm started stridently sounding, an alarm that was so bad that he'd never heard it outside a drill.
Hull breach! Forward torpedo room! Open to subspace!
The explosions quickly became fainter as they plummeted far below the depth the enemy would expect them to dive to, but the safety was an illusion. They were on a suicide dive.
Helm, level us off.
No response from the dive room.
Send any available hands to the dive room. Call the Exoticon.
He staggered through the lock as the helmsman called for all available personnel to go to the dive room and for the Exo to report to the control room. The dive room was located just behind the forward torpedo room, so it might be sealed off. He hoped not, because if it was, they were all dead. The hatch leading into the dive room was sealed, and two sailors were already struggling to open it when he got there. He threw his weight behind theirs, and it groaned and opened abruptly. There was pressure on the far side, thank God. The reason for their lack of response was instantly apparent. The men stationed here were crumpled into a heap on the far side of the compartment, either unconscious or dead. The force of the depth charge that had breached the forward torpedo room must have been tremendous in here. He threw himself under the manual controls for the dive planes and struggled to raise them. They didn't budge. The other men added their efforts to his, and the thick rods moved just a fraction of an inch.
Put your backs into it!
Together they heaved again, moving planes a little bit more. Master Chief Bosworth threw himself into the compartment and added his muscular shoulders to the effort. The next heave broke the planes loose and into positive territory. They all stood there, holding their breaths as the dive flattened out and the hull compressed even further. The out-of-control dive slowly became a rise, and Honeycutt dared to hope that they might survive this wild ride.
Dive room, Con! Keep us at this angle until we tell you to level up. Skipper, if you have things at hand, we could use you in the control room.
Honeycutt quickly checked the men on the deck and found them alive but unconscious. He rose to his feet and headed for the hatch.
You have the dive room, Master Chief. Have your people get the injured to sick pay as fast as practical.
Aye, Captain.
The flasher was leveling out just as he walked back into the control room.
Status?
Lieutenant Gorman smiled at him.
We're back to cruising depth and all compartments are reporting in, except for the forward torpedo room. Sick Bay is swamped with injured, but the only known fatalities are Steve Becker and his four-man crew. All other systems seem to be functional, and it looks like we've broken contact. They're depth-charging the snot out of the area where we were when we dove.
The reminder of the lost men drove a spike of pain into his gut. I'm sorry about the men, but that's good news about breaking contact. It means the rest of us get to live. Helm, keep us on this course. Sound, did you get anything from the targets?
Zucker nodded.
I heard a lot of noise back there as we were diving. I think something might have broken up and been pulled into subspace. I couldn't tell if it was the battlecruiser or the carrier, though.
Let's take a look. Helm, take us to periscope depth. They slowly rose until they were just below the surface of normal space, and Honeycutt raised the periscope. The task force was still swirling madly, hunting for them. He looked from ship to ship and spotted one listing badly and slowly being pulled into subspace, the battlecruiser. It was shattered, venting atmosphere and life pods. There was no sign of the Hirohito. It was gone. A wide grin split his face.
Gentlemen, the Hirohito has sank into subspace.
The crew burst into cheers. Gorman's grin was even wider than Honeycutt's.
We did it!
We did, and more good news. You sank a battlecruiser with one torpedo. Way to go. He let the crew blow off steam as they pulled away from the enemy task force. They had every right to be ecstatic. He was happy, too, but part of him couldn't help but think about all the sailors they had killed today who had only been doing their duty, just like them. Men who would never return to their families. It was a sad, sobering thing. Hopefully, they had done something that would give the Union an edge and bring this war to a quicker conclusion. For now, it was time to bring his damaged ship home and see his wife.